welcome to Creative Psychopaths, a horror movie podcast and the world's premier kitchen for horror sandwiches. What are horror sandwiches, I hear you ask? Well, it's a lovely movie filling surrounded by two slices of chatty goodness. My name's Mark, and as always, I'm joined by Matthew. Hello, Matthew.
Hi there.
I sort of called from you like I was from a distance then, like, hello, as if it was one of those old school seances.
I like to think that we record this podcast just on either side of a moor and just...
Oh, of course. Yeah, that makes sense.
I think that adds an element of romance to it as well.
Yeah, sort of, you shouting across the way. Although it reminds me of that old video. Do you remember that? It's a bit sweary. We'll leave that alone. People can think about that. Anyway, this week we're joined by a guest. As promised, we've got a lovely film director guest in Warren. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, no, it's wonderful to have you here. It's always a pleasure for us to have guests. The podcast started on guests, so it's always nice to get someone to come in and chat about horror. And in your case, we're going to do something really unique and chat about your very own movie.
Yeah, I think this is the first time I've ever like really spoken about it on anything. So that's pretty exciting.
That is exciting.
Yeah, we got the scoop.
Yeah, it's exclusive. You know, tune in here, lads. The Creative Psychopath exclusives. So, well, before we get into that, I normally have a little bit of preamble. The only thing I've got for you really, though, is that I finally finished reading It.
Whoa. Wow, good.
Yeah, it took some doing.
It's a hefty tome, isn't it?
It really is. But I quite enjoyed it. There's some very questionable bits in it.
there was one bit in particular that you got, I see why they left that out of the films.
Yeah, specifically, yeah. It's almost makes you go, I don't know why this is in here. But anyway.
Cocaine was a hell of a drug.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's probably the answer, isn't it? But yeah, I really enjoyed it. And the thing I found about it is that there are moments in the book where they're still fictional moments, but it's when he talks about realistic, almost real life violence, that are sort of scariest moments, which I thought was very interesting. And I found myself incredibly sad at the end when they were all starting to forget each other. Sort of like, and I guess that's sort of how life goes, isn't it? You have, you know, your friends as a child, and then you just sort of grow up and mostly,
yeah, I mean,
disappears,
that's,
doesn't it?
But for all his master of horror reputation, he does often go overlooked at just how good Stephen King does the adolescence story.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Stand By Me as well, or The Body, as it was when he wrote it. You know, it is another one of that sort of nostalgia-tinted walk through kind of an Americana, you know, 50s youth story. And it's, you know, he's very good at it. You know?
And
it sort of is the bridge between those two, you know, facets of his writing career.
It's I was surprised how much it touched me in the end, especially because they come together and rekindle this bond, and then it just disappears from them. It's sad stuff. But anyway, so then I decided I'd start reading The Stand, which is also...
You didn't just think, you know, I'll have a nice, you know, 120-page little novella. You're just going just from huge book to huge book.
Well, The Stand is one I don't know anything about. I've never seen any adaptations for it. I don't really... I mean, I'm getting a vague idea now that it's about some sort of disease. That's all I really know about it.
There was a cover of the book which has, like, two demons fighting.
Oh, really?
It's a really striking cover. Nowhere in the book is there anything like that, as far as I know.
I was just thinking the same of that, because I've seen the miniseries. It's like, I don't remember demons fighting.
Yeah, I'm just googling it now just to try and find it, because it's insane that the cover and where it is, you know, what the story is actually about.
Yeah, well, the version of the book that I got at the beginning, Stephen King saying sort of, this is slightly different to the version that I originally released. I put a lot more stuff in it. I think it's longer. But, yeah. Anyway, that's Stephen King for you. But so that's my ongoing saga of that. But let's stop wasting time and get into this first slice of bread. So we're going to talk to Warren a little bit about his horror history. Matthew sent me the picture of the
I found it and got it all over.
It's come through pixelated for some. Oh, there you go. Oh yeah, that is a weird picture. Also quite a tangent. Well, welcome to the audio medium that is podcasts. So let's go straight in with the first couple of questions. So, which is like, what is the first horror you can remember seeing, and when did you become a fan?
Okay, I think the first horror that I remember seeing, I'd say it's Jurassic Park.
Oh, yeah.
I was like 5 in the cinema, and I was having an argument with my mum about this. She's like, it's not a horror movie, but I think Spielberg's pretty much like the master of PG horror. It never gets enough recognition for it. You know, like Jaws, Jurassic Park, Lost World, even a little bit of War of the Worlds, all kind of like horror movies.
Yeah.
But yeah, I saw that in the cinema when I was like 5. Scared the life out of me. You know, T-Rex attacks and huge surrounds. I'd never seen anything like it. And then really I got into horror mostly through books originally.
Right.
Because I wasn't allowed to watch sort of 18-rated movies and stuff as a kid. Every now and again, something would slip through. My mum liked it and didn't think it was an 18. So a lot of things. Like the first proper book I read was Alien 3, because I wanted to know what aliens was, because the posters were always everywhere. So mum was like, "If you read the book, you can have the book." And so, like little 8-year-old me, I spent ages trying to get through that book. Using dictionary to look up words I didn't know. And like Goosebumps came along. And I think I really got into horror, I want to say early 2000s, so like 12 or something, and I saw Jason X.
Wow, yeah, that's a good place to start.
Yeah, blew my mind. Like, they make movies like this. And, you know, Jason was my sort of like proper gateway.
Right.
Into horror movies. So I started with slashers and then gradually go into more and more different areas of horror.
Yeah, well, that's a decent journey that I think a lot of people start with those early 80s slashers that aren't so bad. And then you can move on to the stuff that breaks your brain.
You've kind of combined mine and Mark's journeys there, because I was a massive Jurassic Park kid, even though it did scare the life out of me as well. It's still one of my favorite films of all time.
So good.
But yeah, and then, yeah, I loved reading Goosebumps and things like that. And then Mark's, you're Friday the 13th guy, so you kind of hit right in the sweet spot for the pair of us.
Yeah. Well done, you're on board, but... both of us agree with you on Spielberg, though. I mean, our 100th episode was Jaws, although I don't necessarily think Matthew thinks Jaws is horror, but we'll move past that.
I just think it works better as more of an adventure film than the street.
I think it's the master of like this PG horror where your casuals can get into it and then refuse to call it horror because they don't want to be associated with that. It's like, but it is like it's got a body count. It's pretty gory.
I'm not gonna die on that hill because, well, for a start, I don't think I really can because it is a horror. It was definitely made as a horror film as well. But.
I just sort of agree generally into Spielberg. I think it was only recently when we did Poltergeist that I discovered that that was a PG. That was a PG, right?
Yeah, that was like essentially.
Although I think that was technically Toby Hooper. Technically.
Yes.
I think in this country it was before the 12 rating was a thing.
Right.
There would have either have been a PG or 15, I guess.
It surprises me because that to me was one of the scariest films I'd ever seen. So the fact that it could be PG was beyond me. Although when we watched it recently, I was like, oh yeah, it's not scary. But there we go. So, well, since she's talked about Jason, let's move on to what's your favorite franchise. And is it Friday the 13th or is it not?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely up there. Like, always got a soft spot for Jason and any of the Friday movies. It's been a while since I watched a lot of them, but I watched them all like in a weird order as well. I remember seeing Jason X first and then getting confirmation that that was part of the Friday the 13th. And then I got to see, I think, you know, random DVDs I managed to find. So it was like part 6. And then 7, you know, trying to track down all the Kane Hodder starring ones.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the original was like the 7th one I saw. And I'll never forget watching that when, because we'd never seen it, but we knew the story, you know, how Pamela Voorhees is the killer.
Right, yeah.
Things. And obviously it's a bit of a murder mystery, so she doesn't turn up at the end. And me and my friend got like goosebumps, like he was seeing like, you know, a famous star. And she's like, I'm Pamela Voorhees. I'm like, it's her. It's the man. She didn't show up in any of the other ones I watched. And I guess Jason X, but, you know, that was like a fake version. I also love Hellraiser. That's one of my other go-tos.
Oh, yeah.
And the Saw franchise, actually. Stand by that. I really like the first 6, you know? I think there's a really good detective story in with all of that. And it gets a little uneven with the sort of torture porn side of it as it goes on.
Right.
But I think it's got a really good mystery story. And those are my Halloween movies. Like, I was the age when I could go to the cinema, and each year me and my friends would go for each one.
Ah, right, yeah.
And then when they ended it on 7, I don't know what to do now on Halloween.
Well, don't worry, they brought it back. What times?
It's not quite the same.
But if you have to pick
they've started releasing them. They certainly did the Spiral, didn't they? They released that in February, I think.
I don't think 10 was near Halloween.
I think last year was around Halloween, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, it might have been.
If we had to get you down to 1... I mean, talking about what you were talking about, apparently there's a lot of good Hellraiser films. I think, do you know what? I think that might have even been me listening to your episode on the Movie Duel. And you talked to Peter about the Hellraiser movies, because I think I might have only ever seen the first one. And we watched Hellraiser Hellworld last April, and it was awful.
So Henry Cavill was the unluckiest man in Hollywood.
Was Henry Cavill in that? I can't remember.
He's the douchebag.
He got very hilariously noshed off.
I think I got a Dutch box set that had an audio commentary with it. And they talk about Cavill in it, and they're saying he's the unluckiest man in Hollywood because he'd like just lost out to Bond and Superman and something else. Like, that point in time.
Yeah, right.
Before finally getting it, you know, Superman later on.
I mean, even that, though, he's still getting done, isn't he? Lost Superman again after being brought back for about 3 minutes, and
Yeah. Feel bad for him sometimes. But if I had to go down to one, it might be a toss between Friday the 13th and the Saw, as I say.
Right.
And I can't decide which. So Saw has this a much this I really like tight continuity between films, which Saw does really well for the first six. And I haven't gone back through for a while to see if like seven onwards carry on or if they start getting a bit wibbly wobbly. And Friday the 13th is obviously very wibbly wobbly, but there's so much imagination in there. I'll go with Friday. Friday is my introduction, and I'll always turn up for Jason.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that because that's my favorite franchise, and actually Saw's my least favorite. So you were really on
I put the
knife,
knife's
and
edge there.
you were on a knife edge with me there. It was you,
A machete edge, if you will.
oh yeah, very much.
Yeah.
Yeah, you either had me sold or had me lost. let's see what would be the next lovely question. So let's talk about movies that need a sequel or movies that need to stop making sequels. Or both, even.
I got one for each, I think, or two
Okay.
for each.
Oh.
I've become quite the Clive Barker fan recently. So
Right.
since 2023, when I finally started reading his books, instead of just seeing the movies. I've always liked the movies, but I never actually read his writing. And I actually really liked the Books of Blood and the Hellraiser remakes.
Right.
And I think, well, specifically Books of Blood, I think we could do a really good like anthology series of movies. So it's these all short stories, so they could just carry that on. It seems wasted just to have the new one come out and then let it die.
Right.
And the same with the new Hellraiser. The new Hellraiser was a little soft, I thought. It could have been a bit more perverse, a bit more gory, but really like Jamie Clayton as the new Hell Priest, new Pinhead.
Yeah.
So I really want sequels for those. Yeah.
Yeah, I quite liked that new Hellraiser. I was pleased that they did a bit more with the other Cenobites.
Yeah.
There's a bit more going on in the
Oh.
it's not just
Are they
focused on
more?
Pinhead and yeah.
Yeah, they kind of more give each one of them something to do, if I remember correctly.
Yeah,
And just.
it's nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Just cool. But I just thought it could be a. If, you know how you get movies that feel like, oh, this was made by a studio or made for TV or something? Because, you know, they've just filed those claws down a little. So, just needs those claws to stand a bit more explicit gore, perhaps.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head with that analysis. It is very made for the studio. Yeah, very true.
Yeah, and a movie franchise I'm going to say should stop doing sequels. I think Scream now needs to stop.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, like I really liked Scream 6, but I found like, and now like all the kerfuffle that's happened for like us going into Scream 7, it feels like no, maybe they just need to let it die now, like. They got such an uphill battle going because now they're going back to relying on Neve Campbell and Courtney Cox and that coming back. And I find it just feels silly when they show up. Like they should just pass the torch on now and just new generations and leave those people out of it. Because the only thing they've got left to make the stories interesting for our old characters is to kill them. And I think everybody would revolt if Sydney ends up dying.
Perhaps,
Yeah, we
perhaps.
spoke about that fairly recently, how it's all just become just a big old mess, hasn't it? And through various reasons, and it's I'm with you, and I love Scream. I don't think there's any Scream film I haven't enjoyed, but it just needs to just stop for quite a while, and I think as well as that, just let horror movies progress a little bit so that there's some more stuff to touch on, because it's that they've they've put two of them out so quickly, and they'll have a third, that, you know, horror's more or less in the same place it was when Scream 5 came out.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, I agree. I agree too. You're spot on there. Right, so let's see. Well, let me try and link it in. So Scream, obviously, is well known for lots of kills. So what would be the best kill?
Why? I mean, you know, I went over this one for ages.
Well, I'm happy for more than one answer. So if you want to fire away.
I got a couple that kind of come to mind. One that like instantly came to mind was almost a blinking and miss it kind of moment is the Silent Hill movie.
Right.
The pyramid head creature, he takes the girl on the steps and he holds her up and he rips her clothes off and then he grabs her by the scruff of her like collarbone and tears all her skin off and like throws it at the camera. And I thought that was such a unique kind of kill when I saw that at the cinema. Because one of those was just like, oh, wow, they flipped their clothes off. And then it was like, wait, did he grab her by the scruff of her chest?
Yeah.
And then just tore all the skin off. You're like, holy shit.
Yeah, that is bad.
Yeah, you know what? I've never seen any of those films, but I think I might need to now. That sounds insane.
So I really like the first one. They went and tried all bells and whistles. It's a different interpretation from the game.
Yeah.
It's less culty, more crazy Christians, but I had a good time. I was a big fan of the games, and I felt watching the movie, I kind of understood the game better, even though it's doing its own thing. Yep. I think it's really cool. It's got some great visuals. It kind of keeps the spirit alive while being its own thing. The second one, very rough around the edges, but the time I was watching it, I was like, this could be the best Hellraiser sequel we've had in years.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
I remember enjoying that first Silent Hill movie. I don't want to spoil it for Matthew, but I remember the endings were a bit weird.
Yeah.
That's the only, and that was might have been the only thing that I didn't like about it, because it's a little bit odd, but I won't spoil it. But yeah, I can't remember that kill, but I'm definitely going to have to go back and watch that.
That one always comes to mind. And then the frozen head smash in Jason X.
Of course. I think, yeah, I'm not sure. I don't think you're the first person to choose that one, because I think it is pretty high on the list of people's favorite kills. Yeah, that's a good one. It's funny, isn't it? Because I reckon like liquid nitrogen and stuff must have been done well before then. Well, probably Terminator 2 and stuff like that. But yeah, in this case, it just works so well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not like it was a new concept, but it's just so, well, it's that Jason level of brutality, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's everything from, you know, just the setup for it, and then kind of how quick it goes over, the effect of her face freezing in the liquid.
Yeah.
Prop that they've got, the dummy, you know, and then just how it all smashes. So, like, it doesn't look like a fake dummy or anything. Like,
No. I like that movie. I can't wait till we get there eventually. We've only done part one and part two so far. Is that right?
That is, yeah. But with the next one, the next one we're covering that's inked in is Freddy versus Jason. So we're jumping ahead quite a bit.
Oh, yes, of course. Oh, well, that's fine.
Freddy versus Jason, I used to watch the last half hour of that movie every day before school for like months.
Oh, really? But the actual fight.
Yeah, like literally the last, I think the fight starts in the last half hour of the movie.
Yeah.
And when I was getting ready for school, by the time I sat down with my cereal, I could watch that last half hour before I needed to leave.
Oh, nice. Well, so what are standout effects for you?
Oh, well, I was trying to think of something unique because I know a lot of people come up with The Thing and American Werewolf in London, which are
Yeah.
fantastic. But one I wanted to give a shout out to is The Laws of Illusions. So it's the last movie Clive Barker directed. And there's a bit in there where a character comes back to life and the camera sort of zooms inside the corpse as it's coming back. And you get an internal view of all the organs coming back, going from rotted shells to breathing life and the lungs filling up with air, and things. And for I think it's an early mid-90s movie, that effect really stood out. I was like, oh, didn't expect that in this kind of movie.
I must admit, I haven't seen that one. That's on my vague list of not really. Oh, hey, having a blank spot.
I love that movie. Watch the director's cut version, which I think is freely available everywhere, to be fair. But I haven't seen the theatrical version, but everything I've heard it cuts out sounds like the film is almost impossible to understand.
Oh, well, that's always good. That's always fun. It's always nice to come away going, oh, I don't know what that was about.
And from what I understand, there's a little bit of a subplot that's peppered throughout that turns into sort of the end game plot. And the theatrical version, they kind of just chop out the little bits that are peppered. So the movie just
All
takes a
right.
hard right, for the last third.
It's always good when they do that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, let's see. I'm trying to find it on Hunt of Illusions.
Yeah,
So
the 101 Films released it in the UK.
I'll add it to the evergreen watch list, although it'll probably move up sooner because I hate having a blank spot. Have you seen that one, Matthew, or is that part of your?
No, that's it's completely new to me as well. Yeah,
So,
you
hot
stumped
take.
me again.
It's my favorite of the movies that Clive Barker directed himself.
Seen it actually because it's got Sam Beckett
Scott.
in, not Scott Bakula.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I was just like, wait, isn't he Scott Bakula? No. Was that his character in Quantum Leap?
that
What
was
was
his
his
kind
name?
of
Which one was his name?
well, was he was a Star Trek as well, wasn't he, at some point? He was
Oh,
a
yeah, he was in Enterprise.
Captain
Captain Archer, I
Archer.
think.
Yeah. Oh
Yeah.
yeah. I always liked Enterprise. Anyway, that's for that. Keep on the horror, boys. Right, so I think the last question before we get into the filling is, what's the scariest horror movie?
Ah, this is an easy one. I've never had an experience like it before or since, but something about the American version of The Grudge, the first one,
Right, yeah.
freaked me out in a way that, when I left the cinema after that movie, it felt like a dark patch had attached itself to my soul. And it was just like I was being stalked by Keiko for months.
Oh,
Okay.
wow.
Yes, I just was really somehow affected until I had a chance encounter in London. I went up to London and I was in, I think, Camden Market. And there was a stand selling art prints or an artist selling their art stuff. And there was a Blu-ray of The Grudge 3. Which I was like, oh, that's weird. What does this have to do with all these very pretty art pictures? And there was a
Right.
sign next to it saying that the artist Aiko Huayachi was the person who drew all these pictures, but also took over the role of Kayako in The Grudge 3.
All right.
It's like, oh, cool, this lady took over. Then she appeared out of nowhere, like a ghost. And she said, that's me. And when I met her, suddenly this dark patch just disappeared. Like, it's not the same actress from the first two movies, but it was like somehow finally my spirit was like, oh yeah, films are fate.
Wow.
And I got to shoot a music video with her, and I got over being haunted by The Grudge.
Wow, that's a great story.
Yeah, it's intense.
Yeah. Yeah,
never had anything like it before or since. Something about that movie, it was weird, man.
No, I can't disagree with you, though. It is a scary movie.
I remember sort of in my big chicken days, I was sort of a sleepover with loads of friends, and they got horror movies, and I was just like, I don't want to watch these, but I can't pretend to, I can't betray my feelings to these people and let them know I'm scared, because that's social suicide. So one of the films was Kiefer Sutherland, Vehicle White Noise.
Michael Keaton was in the first one.
Michael Keaton.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that was...
That was nothing, but the other one was The Grudge. And now I'm thinking I made the right decision to pretend I was asleep on the sofa while not looking at anything going on the screen.
I remember the bit my friend never got over is one of the characters gets killed in their bed. And that was like it for him. He's like, the bed is a safe place. They took away the one safe place we have, under the sheets.
Yeah, everyone knows that monsters can't touch you once you're under the sheets. Exactly. It's perfectly reasonable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can go to sleep and get and meet that burned fella.
Old. Oh, yeah. But he's not in the bed, though.
Well, he could be if he was dreaming about being in your bed.
Oh, crap. You didn't think of that.
No, I didn't think of that. The bed's not safe. You can't go camping. Don't go in the kitchen. That's where the knives are. I'm not quite sure where there is a safe space. Swimming pool? No. Night swim. Oh, kill you. No, nowhere. Just stand and await your doom wherever you are.
Yeah.
That's what I'll do, I think. If there's some kind of impending doom, I think I'll just wait. I'll just hang around. Friends and get me. I'm not going to try and hide. There's no point. It's going to get me.
A cup of tea, sit there, like, this is fine.
And work as a fire. I'd quite like to see a fine old girl do that. I go, well, he's coming anyway, so. he's coming anyway.
I'm going to live as I die as I lived, avoiding exercise.
Yeah, very true. So, that's made me laugh. Let's get into this lovely filling then. So, we're going to be talking about your film, Simon, from 2016.
Yeah.
You made, what year would you have made that? Was that 2016 you made it in, or was it?
So, 2016 would have been the release, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say we either made it in 2014 or 2015.
Okay. Or over both years, was it all?
Yeah. I want to say I must have shot it probably 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And then finished the edit sometime in 2015, and then got our distribution deal during that time. And then it just took a while to come out.
That's, sorry, I wouldn't normally be so straight away find out exactly what year, but I'm very interested by the whole process. So,
2015, we would have got the deal. So I was just looking at one of the other films I was involved with that happened the same time I got the deal.
So this movie obviously is written and directed by yourself, Warren Bedensky. And stars Kaye Alexander Tom.
Yes.
Sarah Anderson, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Chris Bell as Simon West. The internet thing's not quite as good on yours as it is for everyone else. Nathaniel Francis as detective. Go on, Detective Who?
Detective Barker.
Detective Barker. Sorry.
I wonder where that name came from after the last few questions that we've had from you.
Oh, yeah, I thought it was back in the day, so I was like, I'm going to be really clever and put all the surnames after, like, directors that I like in certain ways. So you've got Detective Cunningham, or, you know, Sean S. Cunningham, Dr. Craven.
Of course, Dr. Craven, which is Julian Lamoral Roberts. And
we got Lexi Amy McMorrow as team.
Lexi Wolfe as Becky / Diana. Well, I started following her TikTok today, and Emmy McMorrow as D, right?
And yeah, D has the funniest name because it was originally going to be a male character, and I didn't find any male actors that I liked for it, so. I was like, oh, I'll just call it D while we think of a new name for the character. And I started, like, seeking out some female for it because I was like, there's no reason it needs to be male. And then we just never updated the name.
I like her character in it. Well, I like her, like the characters in general is.
Yeah, awesome.
So your movie centers around... Well, it more centers around Sarah, who is a reporter, really, and then Simon, of course, who is a serial killer. So, what made you make a horror film?
Well, firstly, I'd always made some short films at this period, but they'd always been comedies because I was making them on, like, a home video camera and my own editing and sticking my friends in them. So I was like, if they're comedies, then if they turn out shit and people laugh at them, then we can just say that's intentional.
Right, okay.
So I decided I wanted to do something serious, push myself, you know, to be a real filmmaker.
Right.
And I love horror, and it was also, like, the time of getting into, like, DVDs had, you know, commentaries and things. And so, like, Evil Dead was a big influence at the time. So, like, hey, we went out, we're like, no money, and made this movie. And the job I had just before this, a couple of years back, was working in an autograph shop. And we had celebrities come in to do signings. So I, like, met Doug Bradley and many of the Bond girls and things. But everybody always said horror is a really good way to get in because it's cheap to produce. You just need something in your house, you know, and you can keep it to your house if you don't have other locations.
Yeah.
And, you know, things like masks and boiler suits are quite cheap. And loving horror, I was like, yeah, let's make a horror film. And I first shot a short film for it, which I think was 2013. Which was basically just like 15 minutes, 20 minutes. And it was basically sort of like the opening basement scene, the sort of middle bit where she goes to the house, and then kind of like a take on the ending. So all done in 20 minutes. And after we shot that in like 2 days, I got the idea. It's like, I could probably like really, you know, do this, like, let's see if we can just expand it. And there's sort of like the genesis of it was seeing if I could expand the short. The original idea was just to use the footage from the short and then just fill it out, but then I met Keith Huckfield, who became my DP for it, and we switched from like mini DV tapes to DSLRs because he had a DSLR.
Right.
I was like, well, this footage won't match, so let's shoot everything. We can do that.
So you reshot it. Yeah. Well, I really like that opening sequence. It's acceptably violent.
I like that. Acceptably violent. Good old Lexi says, "Thought by a trait."
Oh, sorry.
Oh, well, yeah, I'm just enjoying listening. Really, it's fascinating. But I think should we talk about the film a bit more before we get into those?
Yeah, of course.
Those weeds, because I've got loads of stuff that I'd love to know, but I feel that we'd be shortchanging the film if I just dived into them straight away.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah,
that's fair.
Go for it.
But having listened to that first slice of bread, it's made it sort of clear where those inspirations have come from. Because, you know, a lot of it is that detective aspect that you spoke about with Saw and how much you enjoyed there. Because, I mean, that is our point of view character, isn't it? In this, it's a journalist trying to crack the case.
That's right.
More than policemen. So, you know, I like that. And I did also like it how it gave me Hellraiser vibes as well, in that it is very much, you know, suburban Britain that this film's taken care of. It doesn't have a supernatural element, of course, but, you know, it's interesting to see how these things play out in normal people's living rooms and, you know, your houses, like, you know, like it does in the first Hellraiser film.
Yeah.
So I think seeing those things come together it makes a lot more sense after what we've just been hearing from you.
Yeah, yeah. I must admit, though, after watching this, I was expecting Silence of the Lambs to come up on your in one of the questions somewhere along the lines. Because
it's got Silence of the Lambs. It's definitely a big thing on this, because when I was first writing it, I was very aiming for a kind of Friday the 13th, but then I was like, I can't afford these kinds of effects. and then somehow it's just like, oh, we should go more Silence of the Lambs with it. I think I must have been watching it at the time. It's like, make it more about the mystery. But yeah, Silence was definitely an influence on it.
Oh, well, that's fair enough. I saw that. Because the sound or the sort of, I don't know if it's a killer's theme or some of the theme music in there feels a little bit influenced by it too. It's good stuff. Yes. Yeah. What else we got? All right. So I really like the fact that you've got Simon very conflicted with himself. But it almost in a different sort of way than that I've seen from anything else.
The two shades of the same bastard, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's not like it's there's no Gollum Smeagol dynamic here. It's Gollum, but Gollum, yeah. One of the Gollums has a mustache. You know, it's that sort of thing, and there's the two. You know, the two sides of that personality, they're both murderers. They both want to kill folk. So one of them is a bit more aware of the fact that they might get caught.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. No, it was really good. I really enjoyed that element of it. Yeah. That's nice to see something different.
I always try to be a little different if I can. But yeah, I thought that was... that was something I kind of think where the inspiration from that came from. But yeah, I thought it was interesting. I think I must have seen some more real life, like, serial killer things at the time. And there always seemed to be this theme of, like, almost like a junkie, you know, so instead of needing their fix from, the next high, their next high was murdering someone. And then, you know, part of Hathorne's like, we got to keep it together. Let's not get hasty. And the other one's like, I need my fix.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that...
That's what comes across.
The way you've just explained it. I mean, you would, because you wrote it. But that is exactly how it comes across. You know, it's... what one of them... It is more circumspect and... willing to be patient, and the other one just driven more by just id, and
that's the word.
Yeah, they're desperate to get that fix, as you say.
Yep.
What are some of the things that looking back, Warren, you enjoy about the film? You know, what are you happy about and pleased that you managed to get on film?
Well, I really enjoy a lot of the performances. I think actors did really good jobs. Some of the visuals, like, it's little things where we only had like a tripod and then handheld. Like, we didn't have slides or anything, and there's just a couple of little like handheld push-ins and like faking having a slide that I managed to do really smoothly. Like,
all right.
I'm always like, yeah, back when I had steady hands. And then the opening always amazes me when they're at the crime scene of us, because we had a site and it pissed down with rain. We're like, well, we can't film. We've got this police tape set up and this tent set up. And we ended up getting kicked off our site and then just being stuck down like a... dining out in some like back end little cafe, wondering what we're going to do. And then my producer Joe just turned up with like 10 umbrellas. I was like, oh, we can shoot like just behind here. And, you know, we'll stick the cameras under the umbrellas. Like, we'll all get soaked, but the cameras will stay dry. If they've been able to pull that off from real like day one, I think it's going to just all fall apart.
Yeah.
It's great. Managing to pull off anything that's in the basement, Simon's basement, was all shot in one day.
Oh, I see.
So, always amazes, that stuff always amazes me. And the grade that I did on that as well. Because we kept trying to make it dark with these little spots. And for some reason, we just could not get it dark enough. Like, it always shined up beautifully. Like, God's sake, like, well, we're running out of time. You're just going to have to shoot it. Maybe I can, like, darken it in post. And then I managed to make this weird orange thing and really pull out those shadows for it. And I'm always, like, amazed that we managed to pull that off. So, because I think that all looks really kind of haunting and beautiful, just being bathed in all that sort of orange.
Yeah, I think that was what my favorite location in the film as well. You know, the plastic sheeting just gives it that. It gives it that way for the light to sort of come through more softer and give it like a glow rather than something quite harsh, which you would probably expect to find in that sort of location normally. And it's also gives it that sort of that nasty, sort of grimy, butchery, sterile feel to it, which, you know, it's obviously not the place that you want to be around when there's a killer around.
Yeah, absolutely.
and the cling film as well, you know, that got me the same way. I think I've only ever seen cling film used like in Red State as well, and both times I've just thought this is revolting in a way that I can't really put my finger on.
Yeah. It was quite fun trying to wrap Lexi up in the cling film and Katie, because it seems like a good idea until you try and run cling film under a massive table.
It just keeps breaking.
I mean, I can't run cling film around anything. I'm terrible with that stuff. So, yeah, so that's off big time.
Yeah, we had to stand them up, sort of wrap their legs apart, and then when we were doing like actual wrapping, we'd sort of have them on the table and stick one side down under the table and then just pull it across. So you never get like full wrapping. It's just like the last bit that you get to see pulled across them.
Well, you can't tell though. They look completely wrapped up. But one of my favorite parts of the basement bits are, you know, what you were saying about what you can and can't do with effects. You do just enough suggested horror to have it go into your brain that that's actually what you saw and that's actually what happened. So I think it's quite a skill to do. I enjoyed that part of it. For example, I think, he's clearly going to cut someone's head off, the first girl, and it just makes enough contact with, you know, with that area for you to go, which is what you want. Good and, stuff.
It's very nice of Lexi to trust us that we weren't going to cut her head off. To be fair, it's her fiance at the time played Simon in that scene.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, sort of. There was just a thing where Chris didn't want to be around the girls when they were unclothed, like the relationship he was in. He's like, didn't feel right, and so anytime there's like Simon's involved with someone who's naked, it was a double, like the mask goes on.
All right, okay.
There's something, yeah. Just one of those things, and then I think the scene worked better with her fiance playing the role, because he's an actor. He was an actor anyway, the guy that we had. And, so that's someone that she felt comfortable with. So, you've got a real sore, someone you trust and, isn't just someone you've met a couple of times. So I think we got a couple of shots that, she might not have been so gung-ho for if, if it hadn't been with someone that she trusted as much.
For a psychotic serial killer, Simon seems like a real gentleman.
He has his moments.
I mean,
there was one thing that I did really like about the costuming, actually, with Simon.
Mm.
How that just because he's this guy who has like no real social skills, just enough to sort of get him victims. I just loved how every time you see him meeting up with someone, he's wearing the exact same outfit every time.
Yeah.
Just that very functional, this is what I'm wearing to meet people. I'll kill them so it don't really matter. Yeah.
It's just got six of the same shirt and same trousers going by. Yeah,
I think you see Simon sort of either side of those scenes, don't you? And I kind of thought it was the same day for a minute, and so the other characters had changed. I'm like, oh, that's actually a really nice little touch.
Yeah. It's definitely intentional. That's good, but happy accidents like that happen all the time. I know Chris might have come up with an idea about that as well. I might have been a character choice on Chris's part, now that I think about it. Saying that Simon should always wear the same kind of thing.
I mean, but don't pawn off on him. You're the other director, that's yours. I never catch Kubrick doing that.
But one of my ideas is definitely that I always felt Simon's like killer outfit should be a little shit. So it's got to be like he's gone to Poundland and picked up some masks, because... Well, one, the white just stands out really nicely, but I always felt like Simon himself, because I always find in movies, like, the serial killer's usually really intelligent, really smart, and I was just like, what if it was a guy who wasn't very smart and has just kind of gotten lucky?
Yeah.
Like, the system's just somehow managing to enable him because nobody's really doing their jobs properly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as soon as there is a whiff of trouble, it's just move.
Yeah,
there's never a suggestion that he's smart enough to work his way out, or he's giving himself an alibi or anything. It's just okay. Yeah, it's gone a bit tits up. Let's move again. And it's
because that was another idea. Something about Someone was telling me like DBS checks or like certain criminal background checks only go so far. So right. If you moved further enough away across the country, it wouldn't necessarily flag up with whatever the system was. It's like, right. That's pretty weird, but...
So, and worrying.
Yeah, grain of salt, like, could have been absolute bollocks, but, you know, it worked for the movie, so that was, like, the personal handle for him, like, moving around, so at least he believes that, if nothing else.
Right, yeah. Well.
Well, should we jump into the questions about the actual filmmaking process? Because I'm eager to dive in there.
Yeah, go for it then.
You actually do have another film coming out soon, don't you?
Yes, my second film, Dead Name, should be coming out later this year. Any luck? So we're just in quality control on that at the moment, and then should hear dates and things very soon because I've not had any issues come up.
What was it called, sorry?
A Dead Name.
Dead Name, right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we'll certainly get the full promotion here. And
We
would love to have you back on to discuss it when that is available.
IMDb suggests you're doing Simon 2 as well.
Yeah, I saw that. One of the actors put it up.
Like, oh, really?
This film came out because we were planning to do another one. I have a script, but it's not called Simon 2. It's nothing about it sort of exists in the real world. But the actors wanted to look like they were busy. So I was like, okay. Yeah. And they got out there and it's still there, even though there's nothing about it.
I know. It even says you're in post-production.
Oh, does it say post now?
Yeah, post-production.
It's always said announced forever, so somebody's updated that.
Yeah, no, it's you're just editing it as we speak. So yeah, we'll look forward to Simon 2. Simon 2, Simon Says, or something.
That would be good. I actually thought they were going to use that as the tagline for this film. You know, on the little like poster cover. I really thought because. Tales is something I struggle with. So I put Simon as a like placeholder title. It's like the distributor will pick something, you know. And then when they went with Simon, I assumed they'd have like a cheesy line underneath that says, Simon says die. But instead they went with every killer has a need. Yeah.
Simon works lovely for it. It's
quite catchy.
Yeah.
There's a slight bugger when it comes to looking the film up. So anytime I type it into like Prime, I just get all the Simon Says like Bop It games come up, and then it turns out like every other film from Spain is called Simon. So a load of Spanish titles come up. There's like,
well, searched for it on an Amazon Fire Stick, and when I searched for it, I got a lot of actors called Simon as well.
But it came up quite nicely on Netflix, for me, which is quite cool.
But it is available on Netflix for anyone who wants to watch the film. We certainly recommend it. It's available on Plex with ads as well. I saw it there, and. Oh, cool. It's only 99p to rent as well, so
yay, it's gone back down in price.
Essentially, it's very, very available.
You've no excuse not to watch this. Get out there and review it.
Yeah.
Nicely. Anyway, I think Matthew is gonna ask you more filmmaking questions.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, so I mean this is a film that has a lot of DIY attitude, you know, and it's what you were saying before about, you know, horror, just you get in there and you know, you just make it happen with what's around you. But it's like, is it Is it like, is this something that you had to go to financiers for? Did you have to find the funding for that, or did you just go completely off your back for it?
Well, what happened was we had the big like Kickstarter and Indiegogo craze going on at the time. So we tried raising money through that first, because I was like, you know, you see all these other things are raising hundreds of thousands. Like, we just need like $5,000 or something, and then we can pull this off. Because and I just got money from friends and family, and I botched the campaign on there wonderfully. Because it was all friends and family, I would have made more just going to them instead of like losing the 20% or whatever it is to Indiegogo. And so we raised like next to nothing. And I basically turned to everyone and said, we've got no money, but we have the equipment, we have the locations, we've all taken time off work. Shall we just continue? And I'll make sure to cover your bus fares and train fares and, you know, keep everybody fed. And everybody was game for that, because for nearly all of us, it was our first like stab at a feature film. So we all showed up giving our time, but I was trying to make sure nobody was out of pocket for doing the movie. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a great story in and of itself, you know, that
yeah, like
people are doing it because they want to be there, you know. And
it was a fundamental misunderstanding of how Evil Dead was made. Because from listening to them talk about it, you know, back then it sounded very much like, yeah, we just got a camera together, and like, you know, we buy little things we needed, and it was just a bunch of mates. And then you read up later on, it's like, oh no, they like raised $300,000. And
yeah, I think if I'm right, didn't they get lots of money from a dentist?
Yeah, apparently dentists are super rich and really willing to, like, you know, just chance money on a movie. I think one guy was gonna like do his yearly Vegas like spree and flipped a coin and then gave him his gambling money for Vegas. And then their like dads gave them a loan and whatnot. It's really good, interesting DIY stuff. But, you know, it also helped me with like Loomis. That's something that's kind of like disappear if we don't keep physical media alive, I think, is all these little like behind the scenes stories of how people put stuff together. Now, the little pitfalls you get. Because obviously we made like little contracts for everyone and things. Because that's the thing that usually kills films on this level, is nobody does paperwork for it. So you don't have any contracts, and then you can't release it because nobody will sign on, or you just can't find people. Because not everybody stays in the business. You know, at this level, they give it a kick. Decide like, you know, they can't do it, go off like a regular life, but you can't get hold of them through email or anything.
Yeah, I mean, that's just something that you probably wouldn't consider normally unless you'd been wised up to it before. And like you say with like DVD extras, it's like it's a free film school, isn't it? If you pay attention and you look at the right things.
So two things that really saved this movie, like, just while we're on DVD extras, was one, listening to the audio commentary for Resident Evil, the Paul W.S. Anderson movie, because they fix a lot of shots in that film in post, and they just describe how like they managed to just do a digital push in on a couple of, you know, shots. I think one of them is like a shot of the vent near the beginning, and the camera kind of zooms in onto it. And that was something that they added in post. So they had the normal shot, and then the editor suggested just digitally pushing in on it to make it a little more dynamic. So there was a couple of shots that I managed to do that with. Or like designed, because I was like, oh, I know I can just slightly push in or slightly stabilize something. You know, so not to say fix it in post, but know that I can work around a slight issue in post. Because you never want to rely on fixing something in post. You really want to get everything as good as you can in camera. But I know I have leeway if I want to try an idea and it doesn't quite work, or I know I can fix certain handheld jitters, which was really cool. I think that the Evil Dead commentary is pretty good for understanding DIY like techniques. Paul W.S. Anderson's usually pretty good at explaining how they do stuff. Half it's useless at this level because, you know, you're not dealing with CGI or like techno cranes or something. But some of it you can like actually apply on this sort of level as well. Yes. How to like make something up. And Michael Bay saved this movie as well, which I forgot about until we started talking. I was just going over script notes while we were shooting. Just had Transformers 2 on in the background, listening to the commentary. Like, I like listening to commentaries as I sort of work. And he had a day where it rained or something. And he was like, fuck it, insurance day. I forgot to ask if it's okay to swear on this podcast.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah,
it's fine. Cool. and they were going to take an insurance day, and then he was like, "Nah, we can do something," and pushed himself out of bed and shot something. And this is relevant because on the second day of shooting, I think we did the basement stuff. We were supposed to have a location for like 2 or 3 days, and then we only had it for that day. And the night before, about 9 o'clock in the night, I get a message from the makeup artist saying that she's feeling really sick. The world is spinning round and she's in cold sweats. And she's going to try and find someone to take over. Because at that point, Katie's face is all half bruised. You know, because she's been like knocked out and got like cut on her face and stuff. And she couldn't find anyone, and I'm up half the night trying to find people, and no one is free.
Not yet.
And I was just like, well, that's the last third of the movie. I've got one day to shoot it. I can't shoot it. Like, maybe we can. I was just like, no, that's it. I'm going to have to like throw in the towel. And I just thought about that bit in the Transformers 2 audio commentary of Michael Bay was, and the same moment, and I was like, no, I'll find somewhere to shoot what I need to shoot. And it's like, if Michael Bay can do it, and I wasn't thinking about the fact that he had $150 million behind him, but if he can get up and shoot something, then I can get up and shoot something. Yeah. And we spent the first couple of hours trying to like work out what to do. And then Katie was like, I can do the makeup that you want, but I can't match it for another day. I was like, doesn't matter. Like, we're shooting all the basement stuff today. Like, it only needs to last today. Right, and then we'll put it enough in shadow that if there's any like, inconsistency, it shouldn't show up. And, that's how we pushed through that.
Go Michael Bay.
Yeah.
I mean, that's probably his greatest contribution to cinema, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, poor old Michael Bay.
God, I'm sorry. That's too mean, isn't it?
Probably a little bit too mean, yeah. Yeah. No, but I mean, I stopped listening to audio commentaries, and I really should go back into them, because, as you say, it does really give you that extra depth that sometimes you need for movies. Mm. I think the last one I did was when we had Ghost Watch on here, there was actually two commentaries on that, and that was really enjoyable too. And as you say, exactly on that one, that was when they talk about how the filmmaking process for that went. It was really, you know, really interesting, really interesting stuff. So, yeah. What else? I must admit, this is all very interesting. It's all very
awesome. I always worry that sometimes it's not, but I just definitely recommend Sync. She's like, Rob Zombie's always good. Paul W.S. Anderson movies usually good because they usually get to be a bit candid,
Right,
So you get
yeah.
some that are very like clearly chopped up or taken from interviews. Like generally anything with Schwarzenegger ones, like good for a laugh, but not overly interesting. But those two and Bay, when he did some, were actually pretty interesting on filmic levels. And if you can find any indie movies that do them, they're usually pretty interesting. You don't get them very often, but every now and again, like you find a real indie film and they'll tell you how to, they like jury-rigged a couple of like strings and things into some kind of steady cam or, you know, weighing the camera down on one thing while holding a mic in the other hand and like pushing the table closer or something.
Okay, I'll I'm gonna jump into my my next bit then, because that's what made me think as well. It's because I know that with the this film, obviously, it's like you say, it's hard to put together, and it's not working with much money. How do you cast the film like this? Because we all often think of like fantasy casting for projects and things like that, and we all have our Rolodex of actors in our heads, but when you're doing it so DIY, how do you find people like this? Is it local theater groups and stuff, or
So,
do you have agencies?
there's a couple of really good websites, or at the time, I used a website called Star Now or starnow.co.uk, which was basically specifically for people like trying to break into the industry. A lot of people trying to go from amateur to professional, and put a posting on there. Mandy's the new big one. But yeah, I literally put a posting on that and possibly a couple of like random, almost like a Craigslist equivalent, maybe. And yeah, put posts on that. Chris, I'd met. Because I did some camera work for his film Hooligans at War, which is a crazy thing that happened. But we started shooting that like before Simon. And I generally like to, I was doing short films at the time, and I kind of like still doing a short film when meeting new people if I can. Because a short film's usually like a day out of someone's life. And if it's an interesting idea, they'll come up, and you can usually see how well you work with someone on a short. You work a day or two together, then you see if you gel. But back to it. So, I used this website, got a few applicants in, and then found a sort of meeting room. We actually used Royal Festival Hall as our like meeting area because it was dead during weekdays, and me and my missus like went there and we put like a couple of tables together on one of the floors, and I just took a bunch of like plastic cups and filled them with water and made a little office at the top of the stairs, and nobody bothered us, and then just met the actors, and usually have a little chat. Got them to read some lines. Set up a little camera so I could watch the tapes back. Afterwards, and that was basically how I sort of like set that up back then. And then some people get referred, like Katie recommended Emmy for the D role. Dean Martin is a friend of Chris Bell's. And I think Judith was a friend of mine. Lexi, I think, auditioned. And so it's a little sort of mixture of also knowing some people from other things. But yeah, for this one, mostly just put up posts for each character, interview the people I liked the look of. And then, went from there. I find these days showreels help for me because if someone can do performances, then I can see something that I kind of like in any of those. Then I just need to talk to someone, see if we'll get on.
Right, yeah.
And
I mean, that's it's really charming, you know, that is it? It's again, you know, like you're saying about, you know, people were working for very little, you know, because the funding's not there, to people bringing the friends and you know, encouraging others to join the project and things like that. It really is a story of community, isn't it? And it's,
Yeah, I know.
you know, for a pretty horrible film about some pretty horrible stuff, it's got a very gooey center at behind the scenes, hasn't it?
Yeah, like I always believe that the best work comes when people are sort of happy and having a good time. I've always felt acting and filmmaking is just, when you're kids and you played make believe, it's just an extension of that, like pretending to be the characters that you played as kids. I know you did with toys and things that we've just kind of grown up and decided to do it and film it. And that sounds weird that I've said it out loud. But it's all maybe so. I'm just, my mind is always like, let's not stress over anything. I don't think, I always find it weird when people, there's like a real school of directors who pit their cast against each other, or like try and get people to sort of like dislike each other if their characters dislike each other. And I'm always like, they're actors. They can turn this on and off. Like, some of them need a little longer process to get in and out of things. Some of them can flip a switch. But I find if they trust each other, they're willing to, like, go a bit further with their performances and things. I don't know if that answered the question at all. What was the question?
Yeah,
I mean, it wasn't as much a
absolutely, it
question, it was
did,
more of a
yeah.
statement of.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Sorry. The community. Yeah, and I think there is a big community in the film world, and I think a lot of people genuinely want to sort of like work together and create something together. And I think it's something that I found in, I'll say I can't speak too much for the American side, but I find the American side gets very snake-like quite quickly, what I've heard. And I found, like, at least in the people that I've met here, that there's a bit more of like all trying to lift each other, be there for each other, sort of thing, and not as much sneaky things until larger sums of money are involved. And then it's usually the management producing side that are just screwing everyone out of money.
Yeah, so I mean that's, yeah. The longer you can avoid that, the better.
Yeah, and at the moment I've managed to avoid it. I think the people I've worked with all seem to have been on the level. They might have issues in some of their other productions, but I've been all right, my end. And I know I've treated people as well as I can. We never had like a big bust up or anything on this. I think we had one moment where Katie got upset for like 2 seconds because she misunderstood something we were talking about. So I was with Keith and we were going to shoot the bathtub scene. And she's getting ready in another room, and we're running the bath, getting nice and warm. And then Keith like puts his hand, he's like, oh, it's warm. Like, yeah, perks of the job. Again, so that she gets to sit in a nice hot bath for a little bit. But obviously, from her point of view, she just hears us talking about the scene a little bit, and then just hears a guy going, ah, perks of the job, as she's undressing in another room. So she's like, what are you guys talking about? I was like, no, we're talking about the bathtub. Like, we're not being dickheads, I promise.
Yeah, I suppose that also helps when you've also established before you've created an atmosphere where You know, you're one of your leads is stepping away from scenes because of the comfort and stuff. So it's, you know, it's a respectful set in that regard. Because I mean, you hear horror stories, don't you, far too regularly. So.
Yeah, and a lot of it seems to be just people not being upfront about stuff. I think there's still this stigma, might not be the right word, but like this embarrassment around shooting nude scenes and things, not from actors, but from like the directors, you know, where they think if you ask someone, you know, you gotta kind of hide it and sneak it in there, otherwise, like nobody's gonna say yes. And
It just makes the thing all so much worse, doesn't it, really?
brings me back to Friday the 13th. There's the Crystal Memories, I think, had come out, or Crystal Lake Memories, and they talk about in a couple of movies trying to convince actresses, or the actresses talk about like trying to be convinced to like take their clothes off or something. Some people said yes, some people said no, but like it was one of those where a couple of them got asked like on set, you know. And I think a couple were talked into it and a couple like refused because, you know, they knew where their contract stood. And they were like, you know, it wouldn't have been a problem if I'd been told about it like in the audition or in the job posting. So I always make sure to put it up front on the job posting. Because even with like, you know, you put it in the job posting, you still get people apply for these things who haven't read it. And then you bring it up on the initial like interview, and some are like, no, it's not for me. And then that's not your actor, you know. And I think people get too obsessed with being like, I want that particular person, and that particular person isn't right for the film. You know, it's not their cup of tea. They're not going to do their best work. While if you're upfront about everything, you find the person who's right for your role. At least that's my theory, anyway.
Well, I mean, you're far more
Good one.
qualified than we are, so.
I just find everything works so much easier when you're just upfront with what you want from your actors, instead of like trying to
Yeah,
mess
and again, it
around.
goes back to what you were saying about that snaky behavior. It's not conducive to being, you know, to be part of a successful project. You know, if you were, if you're not going to be, you know, professional from all sides.
And you know, I oh God, that reminds me of I had a little like checklist when I was making this movie. I had something about I wanted it to be serious and like, you know, sort of more grown up, and I put in there that I was going to have a nude scene in the film, simply because it's like I have to write something that's good for someone to turn up for no money and like do that.
Right,
So
yeah.
that's going to push me to make something good because it's got to be worth their time to like look at it and say yes. If it's just stripper number two in the bar or something, that's going to be a no. Unless you're throwing out some money, because like it's not going to be useful for a show reel. Well, mine, but you know, if you've got a nothing part that you're just showing up for, you've either got to give someone something good to work with, or something that seems interesting for their like show reel that they can at least promote themselves with, or you got to, you know, give them a decent amount of cash. So. As I didn't have cash, I tried to write everybody good. And I find there's a trope in horror that your lead is never naked on screen. I thought, oh, that puts her in a danger zone because, you know, if you get naked in a horror movie, you've got the big chance of dying. And I think we played it off more as like a vulnerability, like clothing is armor as opposed to titillating.
Yeah, I must admit, I thought she was gonna die. Hey, it worked.
Yes.
I'll get in the old bloodlust out again.
Well, I had a working theory for this that went miles off because you've got a secondary storyline that there's already been a serial killer in this town. And for some reason, I had it down that the twin sister had been away for a long time. And I wasn't quite sure, ages-wise, what was going on. And I was like, I wonder if it was her. I was sort of expecting her to show up later on. You know, and I don't know if you actually meant to do that or whether I just made my own storyline up.
So the opening kill and Becky? Lexi's character. The twin sisters. But because I made the short film, the actress who played that in the short film was Australian.
All right.
And we kind of kept the lines that referred to her being Australian in the script. So we came up with this idea that her character had lived in Australia, like she comes from divorced parents and her dad lives in Australia and she lived there and was coming back to like reconnect with her sister. And then...
I just had it in my mind because there'd been a long period of time between murders. I thought, you know, she's been away.
So I can tell you what that's about because I don't know if it comes through so clearly in the film. Is the original killer in this area is the psychiatrist?
Yeah.
That was your that was the sequel there, isn't there, for Simon 2, which is, I mean, due any day now, according to IMDb.
Yeah.
Although
it's clear in the end that the psychiatrist is the original killer. Yeah.
Sorry, I can't see. That's good. I have a few people like, I don't get it.
Well,
I can't help you.
I think if you don't,
we're veterans at this stage. I think, aren't we?
That was my plan for the sequence. This psychiatrist builds an army of like little serial killers that he has in his care, and like sneakily sends them out to kill some people on his behalf because he's too old to really get the job done himself now. So he lives vicariously through them.
That's a good idea. Should make that film. Well, mind you, it's coming out soon.
It's on the way. I thought I'd call it Simons. The aliens
with the yes as being dollar signs.
Yeah. It's good. Well, I'm aware that we're going over time now.
I think you should hold some back because it gives us an excuse to have you back again once Dead Name comes out and we can
cool. Perfect.
Speak some more then.
Yeah, so we'll absolutely get you back for Dead Name. So let's wrap this chat up for now. But it's been amazing hearing you. We did have Alistair did ask some questions, but should be told you've answered them all along the way. So, but they were there, and I know you watched it, and Brian, who listens, he's going to be watching it. So, I think hopefully you get a few extra watches and reviews, which I expect everybody to do. This is your duty, listeners of Creative Psychopaths.
Watch it. Have a great time.
Watch it. Have a great time. Give it 5 stars.
Yeah. This is the little movie that could.
Yeah.
Still. Yeah. Like, when we first released on Prime did a culling of, like, movies at this level, like, loads of tiny little micro-budget films, and just got rid of a bunch of them, like, hundreds, if not thousands of movies just disappeared. And indie filmmakers were freaking out. And I survived like 2 of those. And then when we signed our deal originally, we got told we'd never make it to Netflix because it's such a small movie. Like it just can't pass quality control. And then lo and behold, like 6 years later, we're on Netflix.
Yeah.
Like this tiny little movie just keeps going.
I must admit, no, I mean, nothing against you because you know where you're at with it, but it surprised me it was on Netflix because it is sort of, you know, relatively low budget, isn't it? So And you you don't see much of that on Netflix. So yeah, you know, well deserved.
There needs to be more because we've banned this to death, but we need more support for smaller productions, and we need more eyes on them because that's how smaller producers become big producers, and it's better for everyone.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Right, well, let's wrap it up then. Moving on, we'll move on to the second slice. But before we do that, don't forget everyone to join the social medias. Get yourself onto the Facebook group, where we try our best to chat about the movie that we're going to be watching that week. And of course, wherever you listen to us, please drop a rating. And if you can write a review, do that. That'd be beautiful. But for now, you know, just keep listening, keep enjoying yourselves. Me and Matthew are here every week. So lovely stuff. And of course, follow Warren everywhere. You're mostly Warren Bedensky everywhere, right?
Yeah. Or having a unique name means I can usually get it on most things.
Yeah, good stuff. So
Twitter, X, Instagram tend to be the two places I'm
follow all those
about.
Things, and then you can keep up to date with whatever you're doing next, whenever Dead Name comes out, which looks pretty good. I've been looking it up while we were chatting. It looks pretty good. So let's finally get into this second slice of bread. So the first question I'm going to ask you is, what is the worst horror movie you've ever seen?
Well, this I'm struggling with because it's so easy to name like a studio movie that I wasn't keen on. But, you know, there's like definitely way worse movies. But when you start getting into like the obscure stuff, I feel bad being like, they were worse because you didn't see more of the passion in half of them.
Well, yeah, fair enough.
So I was really struggling to pick something. So I got two, I think, that I've come up with. One that is like a best bad movie. Like, it's kind of a terrible movie, but if you got some drinks in you and some friends, it's kind of a good laugh as well.
Fair play.
It's a movie called House Shark.
Oh, like, right, yeah, yeah.
I think it's on Prime. It doesn't make a lick of sense. The house is haunted by a shark.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of.
Yeah, I've sort of seen it. The only only problem that film has got is it's too long.
I was going to my next point was like, it has the audacity to be over 2 hours.
Yeah.
But it's got this great bit where the basement's flooded and they don't have any like water, so they just put a blue filter over. Yeah. And they've taken the extra step of hanging things by wires so they look like they're floating. You can just tell it's a bunch of mates having fun. So I kind of like to shout it out, but it is terrible.
Yeah.
And what was the other one? It's usually I don't get along with like the I think it's just the director. I don't quite get his movies, but like Midsommar didn't work for me. Because it didn't really feel like a horror movie. Like, it does that thing where it kind of explains the whole plot at the beginning. So I lost all tension. And then the lead girl for it is kind of like at her lowest point at the beginning of the movie. And I was really expecting something really intense from the trailers. And I kind of got a movie that felt almost like a feel-good movie, which I know is now like controversial to say. Like, that seemed to be the consensus when I first watched it. And I haven't watched it since, to be fair. But it does. But as a horror movie, like, it just didn't feel like it was a horror movie, like an art house film. It seemed to be, you know, a film that's kind of, I say, it's like, oh, it's all about the subtexts and really about a woman giving up on Christianity and finding true spirituality after a tragic incident. But
well, that's a bold choice.
Yeah, we were
you know
we were fans.
enthused, weren't we, when we covered it?
You've come on here. We've talked about your film.
I take it back.
Ragging on Midsommar. I can't believe it.
I know. Worst movie. Halloween Resurrection is actually legitimately a terrible film. Now that I think about it.
Isn't that the one that's got the
Busta Rhymes in?
Oh, that's Kick-Ass's movie. No, you're right. It's terrible. It is bad. But at least it's got Busta Rhymes doing kung fu skills on Michael Myers. Crikey, I forgot his name there. No, but actually, I do want to go back because I know a lot of people don't like Midsommar. And I can see why. I can genuinely see why. It really isn't a problem.
Yeah, I would never behoove anyone for enjoying it, but to me, it feels like this shouldn't be a horror film.
This should
be more for the art house crowd.
Yeah.
It's a small distinction, but that's kind of where I wouldn't say it's a bad piece of filmmaking, but like, this isn't for my people. This is for my other people. I like an art house film. You know, I'm quite into David Lynch, though Inland Empire is really pushing it.
But I would say listen to our episode and see if we can change your mind.
Yeah, that's one of my problems. I haven't had anyone to talk to about it. I haven't seen the director's cut version. But it's just for me, like, all the bits I thought were going to be really tense things in the trailers turned out to be these moments where it's almost comforting moments for the lead character, where her, like, state is in the film. She sort of starts her lowest point, and this cult kind of, like, builds her up. It's like, she's having a great time. Like, she's getting better. Her friends, not so much, but, you know, they seem like assholes towards her.
Oh, yeah.
Mostly because they're not her friends. She's, like, the outside girlfriend.
A boyfriend's mostly a dick.
I think that's there's a really good video essay on YouTube, which I need to find the name of. Which I did mention it in the episode actually. The horror is how easily and how how we are so willing to follow this cult and to write this as a happy story, despite the fact that she's basically reveling in the murder of all of the people that she once considered friends. There's something to be said about humanity there, which is pretty dark.
A more literal approach. Because I remember coming out of it and being like, that was really about like giving up on Christianity, because Christian is her boyfriend's name, and just accepting a completely different like thing that spiritually speaks to you more. And I've not heard anybody else say that, and I probably sound like a complete lunatic.
No, it was interesting. There's definitely something there. We should do a Midsommar episode part two and have you back for that.
Yeah.
Well, we'll save an entire slice of bread for the Dead Name episode to to dissecting Midsommar again.
Or not. You don't have to watch a film you didn't like again. You don't have to do that at all. So let's move on to the best. Or your favourite?
Oh, my favourite. Oh, I'm sorry. I was just like, the best? What? Any context? I completely forgot what we were talking about.
I was supposed to be your favourite horror movie. It's all horror movies. Ah. Don't worry about that.
Well, yeah, that makes more sense now. Well, like, I got a top three for different reasons. For, like, scariest is The Grudge.
Uh-huh.
Now, if I just want to, like, ruin my day, I watch that. It's great fun. I love that movie. And then like The Lord of Illusions and The Devil's Rejects are my other two. Like any of those sort of three come up.
All right.
Yeah. So Lord of Illusions is just like a weird kind of noir thriller romance that gets crazy towards the end. I always forget how crazy he gets. And then there's just something about The Devil's Rejects, man. Like, I just love the heck out of that movie. And I got to meet Ken Foray a bunch of times.
Right.
Yeah, it's always fun watching him.
That is the Rob Zombie one, isn't it? The sequel
Yeah.
to House
House
of
Without.
Corpses.
Oh,
Yeah.
that's something that's worth getting on DVD. If you can find like a first pressing DVD of House of a Thousand Corpses, they do these animated menus where the cast come up and just chat over the menus as the characters. And
Oh,
it's
that's fun.
amazing.
That's
Yeah.
fun. Yeah, I really loved Sid Haig in those movies.
Yeah.
Rest in peace. But it's funny, I never liked House of a Thousand Corpses until I watched it again recently, and I didn't realize how very tongue-in-cheek it is. Because I think originally when I watched it, it had this sort of, I think, air or feeling that it was some weird, gross movie, and I think that's what I came away from it. But it's actually really, it's almost comical to a degree. Devil's Rejects is less so, but slightly coming round to Rob Zombie.
It
I really
seems like.
enjoyed the I really enjoyed the monsters.
All right, I did not get on with the monsters.
Oh, really? I thought it was good fun.
I think it's one of those. Just like if I was younger, then maybe this would speak to me more.
Oh, I
But
think I.
I seem to be very picky with comedy. But like with all my friends and things, every time they love a comedy, I'm like, it wasn't funny. And they're like, dude, you have no sense of humor. I guess I do. Yeah, I'll always turn up for Rob, but he's making it difficult for me. But I'll always come out and see something.
Yeah, well, he's not. Sometimes it's a swing and a miss, isn't it?
Yeah, but he's swinging, so I'll give him that. Like, he always goes for a swing.
Suppose we can't argue with that.
Yeah. he's not. Like, I think I always prefer as well when someone takes a swing, and even if they miss, than if they just put out some of fairly generic.
Let's put
Yeah, it's
that.
always way better when someone's willing to have a go.
Yeah. Sort of true of life, really, that, isn't it? Give it a try. Give it a try.
Yeah, I mean,
Yeah.
there's so much formulaic stuff that there always has been in your multiplexes. So finding
Yeah.
stuff that's, willing to go outside the box and give something else a go, it's always welcome.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Right. So that's we just need these very last two questions, which is,
Yeah.
what is a scary moment from a non-horror movie that you remember?
There's something that I found quite scary was in Looper, the Bruce Willis, Joseph Gordon-Levitt film,
Right.
where one of the other guys doesn't kill his future self. And so they like, the bad guys like, catch this dude. And then they sort of anesthetize and just start chopping bits off. And they're like disappearing on his future self. And he finally shows up after like, his nose is gone, his arms and legs. And then they kill the future version. It just lingers on that shot of him in the like, the operation theater and just the heart rate monitor going. And it was just something about someone just cutting you into pieces and then kind of leaving you like that. That's kind of gets to me a little. It's like, that's not a way I want to go,
That's awful. I haven't seen that, but that sounds awful.
Yeah. A lot of people really like Looper. I thought the time travel doesn't work at the end. Like, I was really into it, and then my missus asked how something would work in the original like timeline before they screwed up time, and then it just broke the movie for me.
Don't ask questions.
Yeah.
I had the same problem with the Planet of the Apes saga.
All right, yeah.
The
Something.
original 5, or I think it was 5, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Before they
Yeah,
were
a couple of
rebooted
visitors.
fairly recently.
Yeah, so how does that work? They just came back. Okay. Yeah.
Don't
Sure.
ask questions. Don't ruin your films.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you can Terminator ruins itself a few times, doesn't it? So, does it?
Yeah.
Yeah, why not? I say anytime you're dealing with time travel, though, it's all over the place. I mean,
yeah,
something to do with a butterfly. Hey, I don't know. So if you could make a non-horror movie or horror movie, what would you choose?
Oh, I completely forgot to look at this one. What was it? There was something probably just one of those from the... I know what I'd choose. Maybe I'm like 50 Shades of Grey, because it's not far off as it is. Yeah. You just basically slap a little bit of more Dorian Gray in there, and you got yourself a horror film.
I mean, horror S&M is Hellraiser, in it, so you go down. You've got a route that you like, I think.
Yeah, there we go. I knew there was something Barker-esque about it. Also, is a red door like a thing in the S&M community? Because have you seen From Beyond? Barbara Crampton, Jeffrey Coombs.
I haven't. No.
There's a bit in that where they find like a BDSM kind of room, and it's like a red door, red room. And it's like, did E.L. James watch this movie and rip it off? Like, this idea of the red room?
I have no idea. Well, 50 Shades of Grey. I've never seen it. I don't want to see it. It's not for me, I don't think.
It is not good. It should have been the most fantastic train wreck of all time, and it's just dull. And that is the worst thing a movie could be. It's just very dull. Don't bother.
Agreed.
Absolutely agreed. Well, there you go then. We've done it. We've finally achieved. We've made a lovely, delicious sandwich, as always. So we just have to go get out of here. We never quite managed to finish these goodbyes properly. It always goes on longer than it needs to, as it is now, of course. So let's just go then. We'll say thank you to Warren for coming on, because it's been an absolute treat to have you here.
Excellent. Thank you for having me. So anytime you want me back, just let me know.
Yeah, you're always welcome back. Guests are welcome back. And guests are willing to come on. If you're listening to this for the first time, or you've been listening for a while and thought, I could guest on that thing, then get in contact. We do have an email somewhere along the line. Christopher. No, it's got nothing to do with him. creativepsychopathspod@gmail.com. If you want to email, or just talk to us on the Facebook, whatever you want. Lovely.
Yeah, and of course, check out Simon, available most places for little to no money, and keep your eye out for Dead Name.
And Simon too. Simon too. He's back once again with the Renegade Masters. No, forget it. Right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.